take up that discipline, which is not a difficult thing, but it requires a daily commitment. My experience is when I make that daily commitment, my day just goes so much better. I see people through a different lens, a different filter. And so much so that when I do my classes, I always have 3 minutes of silence at the beginning. And I tell them, you know, I'm teaching you philosophy, but philosophy without practice is meaningless and should be thrown away, according to Francis Bacon.
Welcome to In Search of the New Compassionate Male. My name is Clay Boykin. I support this podcast through my coaching practice. I help people visualize and harmonize, find direction and meaning, or simply get unstuck. Contact me at clayboykin.com for a free consultation. Now here's the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. And I am the co-host of this podcast, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. Gard Jameson is with us today. Gard.
All right.
Gard, this is your fourth time on the podcast. Did you realize that?
I got to say.
Yeah.
You are the leader.
I keep coming back until I get it right.
That's right. Well, let me tell you something. I really admire how you're modeling the way in a number of areas. Your philanthropic endeavors, the teaching that you're doing in the spiritual studies, the books you've authored, and your role as a compassionate father and uncle, you know, yep, the man that you are. So welcome, Gard.
Welcome, welcome.
Be here with my two brothers.
Thank you. What a lovely thing to say. You know, Gard, we have had here in the United States, especially here in March of 2022, there has been so much attention being brought to children as they are growing up and getting their and really understanding their gender identification and how they will be able to present themselves and how they're going to work. Even here in Texas, we have parents who have their children who are trying to struggle with their gender identification, or Child Protective Services is being called in and they're being reported. It's an extraordinary situation, and you have some insight into this experience into your own life. And I was wondering, could you please share with us and help us to have this conversation, please?
Yeah, it's not real complicated. You know, I have a transgender daughter who's now 32 years old. Her name is MJ. And MJ was my son until the age of about 27. And at the age of 27, MJ came to mom and dad and said, "Mom, Dad, I have always known that I'm a woman." And she said something very revealing. She said, I could not have done this in grandpa's generation. And I probably couldn't have done it in your generation. But I feel a certain freedom in our culture to do it in our generation, even as risky as it is. And she said, you know, and this is her Exodus story. Last night I was teaching Judaism at the University of Nevada. And the Exodus story is sort of the archetypal story for us all. And it's the issue of how do we move from enslavement to liberation? And so what I know as a fact is that there are people who are gay and who are lesbian and who are transgender, and they are human beings. And they have an infinite intrinsic value. As my wife says when she delivers a child at the hospital, without duplicate and infinity, irreplaceable in all eternity. And so when MJ came to us and said, "Dad, Mom, I really know myself to be a woman, and I'm going to start making this transition, and I just want you to be the first to know," you know, my declaration was, "Well, MJ, let me tell you something. When you were born, the contract was unconditional love. Mm. And that contract is not been voided. That contract lasts eternally. You will always be my precious child, whether you are he or she. And in fact, I celebrate your courage and your ability to step out with a quality of self-respect and respect for others. Although I've had to have her help me with my pronouns a few times at the beginning, because 27 years of he and him made it difficult to make that transition, but I think I'm there. And again, imagine going into a garden and in the garden saying, well, I like the roses and the daisies, but those vincas got to go because they're just bad. Well, this is diversity, and this is what makes life really interesting and really wondrous. And so for those that have any kind of wonderment or even prejudice, God forbid, about this issue, you know, I encourage you to open up, because you will never celebrate a garden until you celebrate its full diversity. And you will never celebrate humanity until you celebrate its full diversity. And the one thing I know about compassion is that compassion brings a quality of appreciation, a quality of Abraham Heschel. Again, I was teaching Judaism last night. Radical amazement to the realization of the full spectrum of diversity that lies in front of each of us. And so, again, I am all for vincas, along with roses, along with all the other flowers in the garden. And so what happens, though, and what's unfortunate, is that those people who carry the qualities of prejudice that you referred to, and which is painfully occurring across the nation, not just in Texas, but in other states, they are dehumanizing not only transgenders and gays and lesbians, they're dehumanizing themselves.
Always.
They are devaluing themselves in the process. And this is the inevitable consequence of prejudice, bias, and bigotry. And so I always tell people, you know, do you really want to do that? Your life is going to be a lot more difficult. It's going to be miserable. You're really not going to have as enjoyable and meaningful an existence as you might if you open your heart and mind to this quality of diversity.
And that is that's one of the things, Gard, that I think that I know as I'm having conversations with those who might have this prejudice, I'm both looking at myself on how I grow through my own prejudices, because I have prejudice against right now. I am I find myself reacting very much to older white men. I'm finding a prejudice when I see older white men come up on the screen. I find myself recoiling. I'm finding myself on anger that I have had because I'm looking at that. And so that is my prejudice. I am reacting to someone's skin color by the behavior that I have seen and that I have experienced back, even though I am that same older white man. And so I'm trying to see, how do I open my heart, and how do I open my heart to others, especially when there are people with whom I disagree, or I disagree with how they treat other people or my own values.
Yeah, it's really tough. I was at my nephew's wedding in Utah last weekend, and you know, I brought MJ because it's my nephew, and MJ and my nephew are close. But the other half of the family that he was marrying into, it looked like I was stepping into an episode of Duck Dynasty. And nothing against both of your beards, but their beards were really long.
ZZ Top beards, huh?
And they were kind of staring at us and staring at MJ, and we were kind of looking back. And I caught myself, Dennis, exactly the thing you're talking about. And I realized I need to be able to just express such a gratitude and blessing for them and for the inherent and intrinsic value that each of them carries, because they know a lot of things that I don't know. And I'm curious to know, and I wonder about, you know, how they see the world. And please tell me about some of your experiences, because I need to know that. I need to know that.
Guard, thank you. You have just cracked open the code for me. Because if I come in with that open-hearted, if I come in with the curiosity, because my prejudice is when I've already made up my mind. But the curiosity, if I can have that curiosity, everything changes.
Yes.
You know, that's an awfully big ship to turn. I'm looking at myself. And I grew up not trusting men. And, you know, that's a lifetime, years and years through my formative years. And you know, how do I unring that bell? How do I undo that? And, in theory, I can talk about it and we can talk about it here, but I really think hard about it. It's tough.
And it requires discipline, and you're spot on, Clay. You have to say to yourself, I want to be able to see through other eyes. I want to be able to understand. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to celebrate that quality of diversity, but it requires a quality of discipline. So I've just finished a wonderful book by Dr. Lisa Miller called The Awakened Brain. And she's a psychiatrist at Columbia University, and she's done the control studies. And she says, you want to know what the antidote to depression and fear and this kind of behavior that we're talking about? You know what it is? Spirituality. Spirituality. So again, what does spirituality mean? The first premise is that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And the second premise is, if I'm not experiencing what Paul might call the fruits of the Spirit, you know, if I'm not experiencing joy and peace and love, and patience and kindness and generosity in my life, and I know that that is the pathway to meaning, how do I do that? How do I develop those qualities? And it goes back to what you said earlier, Clay, it's about trust. And so the Charter for Compassion, we just had our annual retreat, and it was a wonderful experience. And there at the retreat, I think you know Jeff Chenung. I think he's been on your show, and just a wonderful person. But we have to sort of take up that discipline, which is not a difficult thing, but it requires a daily commitment. And when we make that daily commitment, my experience is when I make that daily commitment, my day just goes so much better. I see people through a different lens, a different filter. And so much so that when I do my classes, I always have 3 minutes of silence at the beginning. And I tell them, you know, I'm teaching you philosophy, but philosophy without practice is meaningless and should be thrown away, according to Francis Bacon. And so we do the 3 minutes of silence, and I tell them, this is a language. So can we learn the language of silence? Because in that silence, we learn about unity. We feel the unity. We feel the connection with one another. And it's palpable in my classes. There's a much more resonant sort of connection that I have with my students and they with me as a result of just 3 minutes of silence. So imagine if you took that to 20 minutes and you had a contemplative practice, because I think what you begin to appreciate is that we walk into this world with nothing. We walk out of this world with nothing. And the question is, what is the note? What is the musical note that we're playing in between the nothing? And the note should be a highlight. It should be a glorious note. It should be a hallelujah chorus. But for so many people, it's not, because of a lack of trust. And why the lack of trust? Because of fear. And why the fear? Because they have not explored their own spiritual depth. And when you begin to do that, everything changes.
You know, I'm going to take a chance here. In my days in the Marine Corps, we had blacks, whites, Hispanics, you know, from every culture. And it was a shared experience, a traumatic experience, where we were brought to the edge together, where it was, we had to hang together or we were going to not make it. And I was fortunate this was all in training. But after that shared experience, there was a bond that it was unspoken, but there was a bond between us because we had that visceral reaction together. And, you know, people would say, well, what about the blacks and the whites in the Marine Corps? And I would say, there is no color in the Marine Corps. We're all green. Now, we've progressed from that because that's, you know, removing a person's culture and the diversity. So it's not quite said that way anymore. But that shared traumatic experience was there's a deep bond that forms that way.
Yeah.
And so for me, the question is, do we have to go to that place to bond together? And your point is no.
Yeah. And I think we can move toward a place of healing and toward a place mm-hmm. of reconciliation. But it does require a daily discipline. It does require, I tell people, if God were to knock on your door, and if you don't believe in God, let's just say an angel, were to knock on your door and say, hey, Dennis, could I spend 20 minutes with you? Could I have a cup of tea and just visit with you? And you were just kind of blown away. Here's an angel. And of course you would take that time. And so again, why don't we take the time for what we call self-compassion, which is to begin to heal the quality of trauma that you're talking about, Clay.
Yeah.
It's not just personal, but it's also collective. We've all experienced this now through the pandemic, and we're all experiencing it now. I'm wearing my blue and my yellow colors for the Ukraine. We're all experiencing now as a result of what's going on in Ukraine. And it's not just collective trauma. It's also genetic trauma. So we're all carrying the bloodlines of generations of trauma. So we have an incredible opportunity to break that bond, to break that chain. Going back to the Exodus story, we're all enslaved by fear, by a lack of trust. So what would it mean if we began one by one, groups, small groups, circles of trust, to begin to trust one another in a deep and abiding way? We just had our circle of trust last Friday. And again, band of brothers, it's just incredible what the opportunity is there. And I have another group with Jeff Janung, and we meet on Wednesday evenings. And again, just absolutely incredible and delicious, the kind of bonding that you're talking about and how it doesn't need to happen as a result of trauma, but that when it does happen, it begins to heal that trauma and literally transform.
You know, thank you so much for saying that, because as you were talking, I was like, well, of course, Clay. I mean, I've been through, you know, working with the Gender Equity and Reconciliation International Organization, the deep healing between women and men. I've been there. I've been at that place, recognizing that we're all suffering and that we're all wounded. Yeah. And coming together with that's in that sacred space, with that acknowledgement and that sharing, that deep sharing with one another, we all come away different. And there is a bond that's formed there. So you reminded me of the answer. I had the answer and I forgot it there.
Well, and again, using it as a metaphor, we're all in the Marine Corps. We're all fighting a great battle. And the battle is to really understand ourselves as compassionate beings living a human experience.
Thank you.
And once we get to that space, as Ken Wilber says, there's no turning back. Once you've had a taste of that, there's no turning back.
How you can't forget it. You can't once we know. And that's one of the things that I love about that word, recognition. It's recognition. We knew this. This is our, we have forgotten that. That to me, and I ask you as a religious studies professor and philosopher, that's what it feels to me, is that there was that we fell asleep, and that this process that I'm going through is actually an awakening of what to my natural state. It's not an additive process. I'm not trying to gain something. I'm actually trying to subtract something.
Yes, exactly. And the exciting news to me is that there are enough people on the planet now who I think get it, who have awakened, who understand that I'm not born to be machismo and I'm not born to be weakling. I'm born to be the compassionate being that I was born to be. And I'm unique. And I have brought something absolutely unique into this story called life. And yes, only I can manifest it. And so again, we're all fighting this great Exodus story. But it requires for us, there's a great Midrash, right? Where Moses is stamping and he's hoping that the Red Sea opens. It doesn't. And one of the faithful starts walking into the Red Sea and is up to here. And finally it parts. I think we're getting there. I think we're seeing the absurdity of what's happening in the Ukraine right now. We're recognizing that we cannot in any way, shape, or form go back, that Putin's really given us some incredible lessons about the barbarity of, you know, what we're doing and the engagement that we're in right now. And so we are on the cusp of something so exciting and so transformative. And I think compassion is the leading edge. So again, I honor and salute both of you for being on that line. And you're still a Marine, Clay.
He is a Marine, and me as a dog face, as an Army guy, you know, I can sit there and appreciate that. But Guard, I need some help here. I'm having conversations, and there are friends of mine from who have different points of view who react so strongly in a negative manner to the word woke and to the woke, how the woke waking is being portrayed in the media, both in the shorthand and the longhand. And can you give us some words on how we can have this conversation? Because it appears to me to be, I don't know where it got derailed, but it seems to have gotten derailed to my perception. Or can you give us some perspective on that?
Well, what I always do is ask questions, Dennis. You know, what do you mean by woke? What does that mean to you? And then to dive in from there, you know, I think what we have is tremendous failure to define our terms.
Yes.
To define our assumptions. And so, again, if waking up is like, okay, so at 7 a.m., do you like waking up and going to get your cup of coffee and stepping out into the world? Of course. And so what we're talking about here is a shift in awareness. And I think what so many people are afraid of is change. And last night, again, I was teaching another course in Chinese philosophy, and Chuang Tzu, who's a great Chinese Taoist, has this image of, you know, once I was Chuang Tzu dreaming I was a butterfly. And as a butterfly in the dream, I awoke and became Chuang Tzu. And the question is, who am I really? Am I the butterfly or am I Chuang Tzu?
Who is dreaming?
And Chuang Tzu goes on to say, this really suggests the transformation of everything. And so again, if you use the metaphor of the butterfly, which I just absolutely love, we're in the chrysalis stage now, where there's a lot of confusion, where we're kind of jelly. We're not caterpillars, and we're not full-form butterflies yet. We're in this transitional moment, and there are a few people like you two gentlemen who are aware of where this is going and are really excited about it, so excited you're willing to take the time and energy to do this kind of programming. And that, to me, is really what is called for now, is more of you who are standing up and saying, really, considering the options, right?
Yes.
As Hafiz says, when you are lonely or in darkness, I wish I could show you the astonishing light of your own being. And if we could begin to just have a taste of that, everything changes.
I'm in a
state of wonder.
This is astonishing, because what I'm learning here. Okay, I'm very in touch with my darker emotions, those emotions of fear and anger. I can feel them in my body. Lack. I can actually feel them. So I have that. But when the more subtle emotions of gratitude and peacefulness and a sense of those are there, but I tend to go right past them instead of sitting with them to build them. Is there an emotional gym? Do you talk about ways of building those emotional muscles so that they are more accessible to me or more.
So the neuroscientists have nailed it. They've said we have TV brains, right? We have Velcro for negativity, and we have Teflon for positive experiences. And so neuroscientists like Dan Siegel and Andrew Newberg said, what you need to do is when you have those positive experiences, you need to just sit there with it, and you need to amplify it, and you need to sort of understand this. You are worthy of this happy place. And so enjoy it. I have a nephew who over the last couple of weeks has been quite suicidal. And I've been in touch with him quite frequently. And this morning I was talking to him, and he said, damn you, Uncle Gard, damn you. Mm-hmm. Every time you talk to me, I know what you're saying is right. He said, Patrick, it's like two fish bowls. And what I'm trying to tell you is the water's warm. Come on over. Right. And he says, I want to. I really want to. And again, what holds us back is that Velcro.
Yeah.
Where we attach ourselves to those negative experiences. And he's generating a lot of animosity toward his parents. And I said, Patrick, you got to enlarge the picture. And you've got to understand that your parents, one of them being my sister, had issues of abandonment and unworthiness and depression when they were your age and younger, and probably much more severe. So again, what's the antidote? Spirituality, and to be more specific, compassion. You need to be a little more compassionate. Aldous Huxley was the great one, a great author of Brave New World, who said, it's a little embarrassing. And this guy, as you both know, is really smart, English.
Oh, yeah.
But he said, it's a little embarrassing at the end of my life to say the only real advice I can give you is to be a little kinder.
Yeah.
So yeah. How do we be a little kinder? Well, we have to take time to do the inner work. And that requires confronting those fears that you're talking about, Dennis.
Yes.
It requires opening yourself up to the nightmares. It requires allowing yourself to feel that abandonment, to cry, and to feel those emotions associated with those dark spaces. But then when you begin to step into that field beyond the bridge that Rumi talks about, to enjoy the flowers, to enjoy them all, the Vinkas too, the transgenders, the gays, the lesbians, yep. All of them, aren't they incredible? I mean, I'm sure both of you have been to events where You have friends who are gay or lesbian or trans.
Of course.
These people know how to celebrate life. They are so exactly. beautiful.
Amen. Amen.
Yes. And that's what I. Yeah. And then I know, Clay, you and I have talked so much about the impact, the softening. And there's a difference between softening and weakness.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that you and I have talked about a lot, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I go back to the traditional definition of vulnerability, you know, and don't let somebody see your underbelly, right? Don't be vulnerable. And then the contrast is Brene Brown, standing your truth with an open heart, be wholehearted. And the spectrum of vulnerability, it's this continuum. There's a time to cover yourself. And there's a time not to be vulnerable in that sense, but there's also a time, you know, like we are today, you know, we're standing in our truth with an open heart. We're showing up to this conversation wholehearted.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's having that awareness, because if I'm aware of that, now I've got choice. Oh, I'm being this way. There's another way to be. It's this way.
It's that awareness, isn't it, Clay? Mm-hmm. So, in every morning, I take 20 minutes to do what we call centering prayer. And after that 20 minutes, I can tell there's a palpable change in the awareness. There's a palpable shift in my capacity to relate to others. And it's particularly good when my wife and I do it, because being married for 40 years, I love it when we're both on the same wavelength, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, again, it's an extraordinary opportunity, but it does take time. It's not something that happens overnight. You can't just will it. In fact, you cannot will it in any way, shape, or form. It's something that you submit to. And that's why I love the term Islam, surrender, right? In Islam, they say dhikr, which means remember who you are. Remember that you are an infinitely valued child of the divine. So when we experience that, when we taste that, it's my nephew. Damn you, Uncle Gard.
Exactly. Exactly.
I know what you're saying is correct.
Exactly. And what we're having, and it's one of those things, would I rather be right or happy? And very often I'll find it. It's interesting that when I will hold a grudge, and I will hold something, I will go, what am I getting out of holding that grudge? You know, I see myself, you know, with a little grudge up to my nipple, nursing that grudge and just sitting there, you know, just, oh, but there is some, I don't, because this happened to me the other day, is that there was someone that I felt really took me to task for something that I rightly did to this person. I rightly did to them, but they took me to task about 20 minutes longer than the lesson, until finally it was beyond anything that I could just. And I found later that evening in the shower, I had this revenge fantasy. I'll make sure that I'll take care. And I'm going, what is that about? What makes that need, what makes that so much in my psychological makeup? So, but I fortunately, I also have, like you, have a wonderful way. I was able to process it and share about it, and that allowed it to tone away.
Yeah, it's that damn dinosaur in our brain.
Yeah, as a part of, I mean, that's one of the things that I love. Gard, do you? It feels to me like there is a shift in consciousness happening on the planet.
Totally.
That we are that we are both the kids that are coming up. There's the inertial power structure that is there, and then there is this wave of consciousness that's coming up, an elevation that is happening. This something very powerful is happening, like Compassion Las Vegas and all the works that are happening there. These things are happening all over this planet.
Yeah. That's absolutely the case. One of the big projects we have locally here is restorative justice, which prior to about 2 years ago was not in anybody's vision. And so we have a criminal justice system, probably a little bit similar to Texas, where we just take them out and whip them, right? It's a punishment system. And so when I heard about the possibility of restorative justice, I leaned in with the attorney general and he said, absolutely, I'll lean in and we'll do this. And so the other day there was a shooting at one of our local high schools and it was one gang retaliating on another gang at another high school. And we stepped in and it was a very interesting experience. We stepped in and we had a restorative justice conference. And one of the people that was there in the circle was a hall monitor who was calling out this young 15-year-old gang leader. And my friend, Pastor Troy Martinez, looked over and he said, I recognize that tattoo on your arm. Aren't you a member of the Camacho gang over in East LA? And the hall monitor knew he was busted. He said, yeah. He said, what you just shared really didn't happen, did it? He said, no, it didn't. Well, the principal who was there and the victims and the perpetrators, everybody in the circle just turned their heads. And this young fellow, 15 years old, leader of a gang, is now pursuing workforce development, moving into a job situation, employment situation that he's always wanted to have. Recognize that his attachment to the gang is not a fruitful endeavor. And is really remorseful and recognizes the opportunity. And this is about restoration and hope. This is about compassion. And what we could have done is we could have taken that 15-year-old, as many systems do, and I suspect in Texas true, we could have said, well, we're going to try you as an adult. And we're going to put you into one of our prisons. And you're going to be there for the next 20 years. And what's the outcome there? You both know. Everybody who's listening knows.
Of course. And the waste.
It's absolute waste.
I mean, that is our, because we are throwing away an opportunity for, I mean, to me, the motivation of a gang, the belonging is a positive motivation that has just been taken in a direct, we can take that same motivation. Yeah. Can't that motivation be something and redirected?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have another program, Hope for Prisoners, run by John Ponder, who basically, when the felons come out of the prison, it's a process of rehabilitation, and it's nationally recognized. It was awarded by the DOJ, and he's a 3-time felon. And again, to see that kind of energy, that kind of genius, that kind of contribution not be expressed in one life. I mean, this one fellow has turned everybody around. When he has graduations of his classes, you know, the attorney general shows up, the governor shows up, the mayor show up, the sheriff shows up, they all show up and they're all applauding. But when he originally came into town and he wanted to do this, they were all turning their heads the other way because This isn't what we do. We punish. And so at some point, we've got to put that little fuzzy dinosaur to the side and say, well, at least let's start using the mammalian part of our brain, which is gregarious and friendly and motherly and taking care of our young, If not the human side of our brain, which has this infinite compassion, infinite wisdom, this infinite courage to do the right thing.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. I'm sitting here pondering, you know, how can success stories like that be more broadly shared? You know, this is what we learned here, and every city have that pipeline to the success stories, because you're modeling the way in so many ways.
It's happening. It's happening in Monterey, in your own San Antonio, Nancy there in San Antonio, and you guys there. And California has now embraced compassion, as you know. Australia, the continent, has embraced compassion. So it's happening. And what we're creating is a kind of neural network. And so what's happening well in Las Vegas will start filtering into other communities.
And naturally. You know, Gard, as a capitalist, I believe that this is actually a value add that we're wasting. We're throwing away. This is like the difference between burning coal or taking that same piece of coal and releasing the energy that is already within it. We're burning coal. This isn't there's a much better use of exactly the same energy that we can take. And as a capitalist, because I believe it's what, for all its failings and challenges, it's still, in my impression, the best societal way of doing. We can do it consciously. We can do that, but it's just a better way to do that. And we are flushing down the drain so much of our capital.
Well, Alameda's done a study, Dennis, on this one. And guess what it costs us to bring that kid, 15-year-old gang leader, back into gainful employment, back into community contribution, versus guess what it costs us just to prosecute that kid? Not even talking about the annual cost of incarcerating that kid, but just to prosecute. So Alameda did a study, $10,000 to move him through restorative justice, $500,000 to move him through the prosecutorial process. Right? This is no brainer. Yeah. I can get both sides of the aisle in on this one.
That's what I'm hoping that we can sit there and just to make the case, just to make sure, and we can make the case that there is, and that's one of the things about, I love reframing, you know, reimagine the police. Mm-hmm. Now that's something we can all do. We can reimagine what's possible. What does the word peace officer mean as opposed to a police officer? How do we reframe? How do we get an opportunity to understand that there is more there than we're seeing, and that we do not have to look at things in a binary state? We're looking at them along the continuum. How do we move toward the at-one-ment, to the one? How do we find ourselves somewhere along this continuum? What are the small steps I can take that move myself toward?
I want to ask something on that, because this has come up earlier. Gard, is there been a time in history that we could go back and model after? Or is this just the nature of the human race?
Well, it's the Eric Neumann did a wonderful study called the On Origin of Consciousness. And again, if you track historically the different periods of consciousness, we've moved from 10,000 years ago, if you will, a more Paleolithic kind of approach to reality and to relationships. We've moved into the classical period where individuality became something significant. And then from the classical period, we moved into the medieval period where, again, the institutions were dominating, if you will, culture. So it was religion and it was commerce and it was the monarchy that was dominating culture. And then we're coming out of what's called the postmodern period, where, again, there's been a deep kind of chrysalis moment, where a deep confusion about how we move forward, with a lot of people saying, you know, there is no God, spirituality is dead, and so on and so forth. But a lot of us saying, no, actually, you're just using the wrong images. You're using the wrong metaphors and symbols. Something quite extraordinary is here, and it's happening amongst us. And so there have been, to answer your question, moments in India where the monarchy was filled with enlightened sages, rishis. And I think India has probably been the most extraordinary culture in that regard. You know, we had a period, you probably both watched the movie Gladiator, where you had the character played by Richard Harris of Marcus Aurelius. There were a series of Caesars who were quite enlightened.
Were there Persians? Were there Persians in the Hafiz Rumi time? Were there some times there also, Gard?
there were different dynasties, and there were golden ages, I think you may be referring to, in Baghdad, as well as in Spain, where Jews and Christians and Muslims lived together. But then, you know, we all learned about 1492 and how glorious Queen Isabella and the king were, but they were burning Jews mm-hmm. at the stake.
Yeah.
That golden era sort of evaporated in smoke. So we have this tendency to regress, but I think we're on the cusp again of another shift in consciousness past the postmodern.
Yes.
I don't know what you call that, but something extraordinary. And again, back to Lisa Miller, what's the flip side of fear and depression? It's spirituality. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be an age of spiritual burgeoning, where again, mm-hmm. what we'll focus on is not so much the institutions, but the values that guide the institutions. So compassion and wisdom, and love, peace. These will be truth, beauty, goodness. These will be the dominating North Stars of the coming age. And when people begin to taste that, again, they will not want to go back. And so this will be a permanent shift. And again, this is a pioneering moment. This is a chrysalis yes. moment. And so it's a little confusing for a lot of folk, but we need to keep persevering, be curious and wonder and ask questions and really reach out to the long beards and all others.
Dennis, you noticed something that Guard was just hitting on. That, I mean, I think this is podcast 104 episode. Mm-hmm. And almost every podcast, unsolicited, everyone's talking about this incredible time of change right now. You know, Rick Tarnas talks about it when talking about the archetypal astrology and the alignment of Uranus and Pluto. And over the years, the ebb and flow of society and what have you. And, you know, and he talks about this time of change from an astrological standpoint. And all around the world, whether it's Tasmania or Australia, Sardinia, mm-hmm. everybody is saying the same thing.
Yes.
It's an incredible time of change. And they're saying it from their own frame of reference and their own vantage point.
Exactly.
I work with my dissertation advisor for my PhD. And again, he and I have had conversations about the way of Pluto or the way of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
And the way of Pluto is through the underworld. And you can get there from here, but it's really a painful experience. And we're experiencing that pain right now.
Yeah.
So we need to bring those two pieces together in a way that reduces the quality of suffering around us. There's a great story of a Texas grandmother who was reading Revelations, and she was sitting there in a rocking chair reading it. And her grandson came up and said, "Grandma, why are you always reading that book?" And she said, "Well, it tells me here that the moon is going to drip blood and the four horsemen are coming. And I'm telling you, grandchild, I means to tribulate." and we can really attach ourselves to that quality of tribulation, or we can begin to imagine, if you will, the way of Aphrodite, the way of love, the way that is much more gentle, the way of water, right? My brother and I always used to get into a bit of a scuffle where he would say, "Tough love," right? And I would say, "No, soft love, the way of water." Mm. Bruce Lee, "Be still, water. Be still, water." He was a pretty tough guy.
Really, Valentine Michael Smith, "Share water." The whole back in Stranger in a Strange Land, I'm revisiting that book and the impact that it had on our society. So that's for anyone that possibly could have heard of that or read of that, but that was, they were sharing water because water is very scarce. So it's a way of having this, but I love the idea of water. And the, we have a dear friend of ours, Martin Dowman, who is now at the Grand Canyon. He's managing a group of tents that are there for people to come in. But the Grand Canyon is an example of the beautiful work of water, of soft water, of soft love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Martin always signs his emails, "In the flow is the only way to go."
Yeah, but there's an important part to that. And the Colorado River is a great image. You need to be in the current, because if you get off to the side, which is basically where a lot of people are, and I'm referring to those legislators and those people who want to come down against transgenders, you're going to find yourself in an eddy.
Yes.
And that's where the rafters have told me. I've been down the Colorado River 3 times now. They've told me that's where we find the kayakers, and they're upside down and they're dead. Mm-hmm. And so again, I encourage people, stay in the flow, right? If you're riding a surfboard, which I did when I was younger, right? You move with the water, not against the water. When you do, there's bliss. When you try to move back into the wave, good luck.
You know, there was a time in life when swimming against the stream, you know, going with the flow is like going, you know, that was like giving up. Mm-hmm. But I started to realize that the harder I swam upstream, you know, I'd get tired for one thing. But the other thing was the scenery never changed.
You're stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautifully said. That, oh, what a great one thing that I love about metaphor and I love about visualizations is that I can get it. I'm a very, very, I'm very metaphorical. I love me's a good metaphor that I can, I ride them until they're dead and I beat them a little harder. And I just keep it. I mean, this is my place. That's what I love about your love of your beautiful. I love, Guard, besides loving you, I love your gift of story and being able to bring us in story. We as human beings, we are story driven, aren't we? I mean, don't you see that in the evolution of every part of us as we're going?
Yeah, but you know what I will tell you is we've lost our story. You know, indigenous cultures, they would go down every morning and they would share their dreams and they would share their stories. And occasionally there would be big dreams, big stories, which would shift, if you will, the culture of the village. But we've sort of demythologized our narratives in a way that's created, if you will, this culture of fear, of distrust. And if we could tell these stories again, if we could share our stories. So, Mr. Duck Dynasty, tell me about your story. Tell me how it was growing up in Utah. Tell me about your background. Tell me about, right, Jerry. I'm thinking of Jerry, Clay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Grandpa and Grandma. What was it like for them in Austin, Texas? When we begin to tell those stories, the heart begins to, if you will, connect. To resonate. And when the heart connects and resonates, then there's a real relationship. Then trust is a possibility. And I think so much of what we're facing right now is people's unwillingness or the sense that nobody would listen.
That's it.
To the story that I have to share. And I have a story to share. And Clay, you have an incredible story. And Dennis, you have an incredible story. And if we could see that each one of us is like a Cecil B. DeMille, you know, that there's this incredible story that, you know, I could tell you about my aunt who spent 50 years in India. I could tell you about my great-great-grandfather who ran pianos down to the South and brought slaves back in the boxes. Mm. I could tell you about so many stories, good and bad, good and bad. I could tell you about the betrayals, my father, my grandfather, you know, and how, thanks to Cynthia and William, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not doing that game anymore. That game is over, right?
Hopefully, one boy. When you said, you know, who's going to listen, basically, and I just in our men's circle over and over and over again. I mean, it's now almost 10 years. Every week, and invariably, it comes up in some way, shape, or form. One of the guys says, "I just want to be heard. I just want to be heard. I don't want to be fixed. I don't want somebody to go tell me their story. I just want to be heard. And don't judge me. Just listen."
Yeah.
And
that's it.
Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah.
Thank you, Gar Jameson, for giving us another time that I warn you, you're going to continue to dot us on our podcast as you come back, as you continue to be able to do the work that you're doing. I'm so proud to know you. I'm so proud to have the work that we've done together and how you listen so deeply. You're one of the great listeners who, because when you listen with a presence. That is that just opens my heart and allows me to have access to areas within me, and it's such a blessing. And so I work to model what I see in you, and of course you, Clay, whom I love, and I have gone so many trails with, and all the people. All the people from the vast, beautiful spectrum of humanity who get a chance to listen, who get a chance to view this podcast, we thank you. And we thank you for giving us an opportunity to be here on the journey in search of the new compassionate male. We shall see you next time.
And pray for Ukraine.
Yes. Check out the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male on your favorite podcast station.